I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
You know what you need in your life? The Final Word Podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of the Final Word Podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay.
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.
MSW Media.
Rule of law is not just some lawyer's turn of phrase. It is the very foundation of our democracy. The essence of the rule of law is that like cases are treated alike. That there not be one rule for Democrats and another for Republicans, one rule for the powerful, another for the powerless, one rule for the rich and another for the poor, or different rules depending upon one's race or ethnicity. To serve as Attorney General at this critical time is a calling I am honored and eager to answer.
So yeah, now it's clean up on aisle 45 time. And for a long while yet, it is going to be clean up on aisle 45.
Hello and welcome to episode 167 of Clean Up on Aisle 45. It's Wednesday, April 3rd, 2024. I'm Allison Gill.
And I'm Pete Strzok. Today we're going to cover the Jeffrey Clark disbarment proceeding in D.C., the limited gag order in the Manhattan DA's election interference hush money case as Trump continues to attack the judge's daughter online, and an update in Fulton County.
Yes, and Mike Roman has been subpoenaed by prosecutors in Arizona, even though he said he was going to plead the fifth, and that, you know, the prosecutors there are investigating the fraudulent elector scheme. And we'll talk about John Eastman's disbarment ruling in California, and we're going to go over a hearing in the Hunter Biden tax case. And we have a lot packed into this show, so there's going to be a little bit less discussion and a lot more analysis, and then we're going to save that discussion for the bonus episode for patrons that happens later this week. And speaking of patrons, you currently have pre-sale links to our live show, including DC in August. That's August 16th. And that's going to be me, you, Pete, and Andy McCabe, and Glenn Kirshner is going to join us as well. Those tickets will go on sale to the public Friday. So grab the good seats while you can. There's also going to be a VIP meet and greet where you can hang out with us and we'll have a drink, a cocktail, or a mocktail before the show starts. So thanks to these new patrons, Andy McNeil, Jill S., DynastyBook.net, Mike, Joaquim, Catherine Cooper, Should Have Been Paying All Along, thank you, Steph F., Keith Penner, Sadie Kozin, Scrolling Blunder, Jeff from Boston. Thank you, you make this show possible, along with all of our events and shows and live performances, so thank you very much. All right, Pete, with jury selection just around the corner, just over a week from now, let's start in Manhattan with the DA Alvin Bragg's election interference hush money case. So on March 16th, Judge Mershon issued a gag order, very limited gag order, after Donald Trump posted a link on Truth Social accusing the judge's daughter of being a major Democratic donor. But the limited gag order didn't appear to cover the judge or his daughter or the DA or the DA's family. Here's the language. It says it's ordered that the people's motion for a restriction on extrajudicial statements by the defendant is granted to the extent that the defendant is directed to refrain from the following: making or directing others to make public statements about known or reasonably foreseeable witnesses concerning their potential participation in the investigation or the criminal proceeding. Two, making or directing others to make statements about A, counsel in the case other than the district attorney, B, members of the court's staff, so not the judge, just the staff, and the district attorney's staff, or the family members of any counsel or staff member, if those statements are made with the intent to materially interfere with or to cause others to materially interfere with counsel's or staff's work on a criminal case, or with the knowledge that such interference is likely to result, and making or directing others to make public statements about any prospective juror or any juror in this criminal proceeding. So after Trump continued to make statements on Truth Social about the judge's daughter, including, by the way, Pete, posting a link showing her photo, the DA filed notice with the court stating they believe the order is read to include the judge's daughter. That was his first filing from the DA. And then Trump filed a motion to recuse the judge because his daughter worked at a firm that represented Democratic candidates. So that was the first filing, right?
Right. And then the DA responded to that, right? Monday, they filed a response to Trump's recusal motion that basically said, hey, look, they conceded the limited gag order may not cover the judge or his daughter, and said, but if it doesn't, asking the judge to expand the gag order to include them and to hold Trump in contempt if he fails to follow the expanded gag order. The DA also reminded the judge that he needn't recuse because the judge had consulted the court ethics panel previously, and they said recusal was not necessary. Then, after that, Trump filed a response to that letter from the DA by doubling down on his recusal motion and accusing the judge of impropriety, writing in part, quote, an expansion of the gag order would be particularly inappropriate given the fact that the court appears to have recently violated Canon 3 by making public statements about the case, unquote. Trump and his attorneys tried to accuse the judge of impropriety during the hearing about the alleged late discovery from SDNY, and it didn't go well. At the time, the judge said, quote, you're literally accusing the Manhattan District Attorney's Office and the people assigned to this case of engaging in prosecutorial misconduct and trying to make me complicit in it, and you don't have a single site to support that position, unquote.
Yeah, so just, you know, leave it to Trump to keep doubling down on stuff that upsets the judge. And in Trump's forthcoming motion to recuse, he says he's going to write this letter. He plans to ask to adjourn, which is to delay the trial, based on pretrial publicity, which is rich because Trump is the cause of the pretrial publicity. Now, the court itself debunked Trump's claims that the judge's daughter posted on social media an illustration of Trump behind bars. His attorneys tacitly acknowledged they never verified that it was her account. This is really bad lawyering, Pete. They say the post was merely attributed to her. So it sounds to me like Trump went out and did something that he didn't clear with his counsel.
Shock.
But we do have some breaking news. As we're recording this, Judge Mershon has expanded the gag order to include family members of the judge and the DA. And I'm reading the order, Pete, and the judge is not happy in this order. He says, to clarify, the previous order did not proscribe defendant's speech as it relates to family members of the DA or the court. The court now amends. And when the judge says the court, he means the judge. So the verbiage, Pete, is like when they say the court staff, that doesn't include the judge. But when they say the court, that means the judge. The court now amends the March 26, 2024 order to include the family members of this court and of the district attorney of New York County. The decision and order is equally narrowly tailored and in no way prevents the defendant from responding to alleged political attacks, but does address defendant's recent speech. And subsumed in this order, Pete, I think is we start to see the reason that not just this judge, but all of the judges in the four jurisdictions where he is currently under indictment, and the three where he currently has limited gag orders, that the reason that they're letting him do this so freely, that, you know, they're treating him differently than they would treat you or I, is because he's a candidate for president. And he, that sort of electioneering speech is really, really protected speech. And I think they're all just trying desperately to avoid an overturn of any conviction on appeal. He goes on to say, this pattern of attacking family members of presiding jurists and attorneys assigned to this case serves no legitimate purpose. It merely injects fear in those assigned or called to participate in the proceedings that not only they, but their family members as well are, quote, fair game for the defendant's vitriol. It is no longer just a mere possibility or a reasonable likelihood that there exists a threat to the integrity of the judicial proceedings. The threat is very real. Admonitions are not enough, nor is reliance on self-restraint. We can't trust Trump to just shut up. Again, all citizens called upon to participate in these proceedings, whether juror, witness, or in some other capacity, must now concern themselves not only with their own personal safety, but with the safety and the potential for personal attacks upon their loved ones. That reality cannot be overstated. And the judge is right. He keeps repeating that point in this ruling. Defendant's desperate attempts to justify and explain away his dangerous rhetoric by, quote, turning the tables and blaming those he attacks. The arguments counsel makes are at best strained and at worst baseless misrepresentations, which are uncorroborated and rely upon innuendo and exaggeration. Put mildly, the assortment of allegations presented as quote-unquote facts and cobbled together result in accusations that are disingenuous and not rational. To argue that the most recent attacks, which included photographs, were, quote, necessary and appropriate in the current environment is farcical. Defendant is hereby put on notice he will forfeit any statutory right he may have to access juror names if he engages in any conduct that threatens the safety and integrity of the jury selection process. So it's not just ordered that the gag order is expanded, Pete, but they're saying here, I might not let you even have the jury names if you continue.
Yeah, and that's a big deal. I mean, you know, everybody has a right to the identities of jurors and potential jurors because you want to be able, as part of your defense, to go out and do research about them, figure out like who might be more amenable to hearing your case and voting not guilty. But in this case, you know, that's something that the judge is putting out there. Roger Parloff, who another good follow on Twitter for those of you who don't follow him already, much like Anna Bauer, you know, called it sort of a sword of Damocles now hanging over Trump. That look, if you want to go mess around, this the first sanction that you're going to face is because of these threats, you're not going to be able to know the juror names, and you're going to give that up if you keep it up. And the other thing is, you know, you pointed out all four of the cases are facing this. You can bet that Jack Smith is reading this order, and I would be surprised if the wording of this order, at least mention of it, works its way into some sort of filing in front of Eileen Cannon, who is still like, well, how come we haven't thrown out, you know, potential witness names yet? What's, you know, what's going on with the timing of that? You know, this is this obvious, you know, everybody in America, except for Donald Trump and Eileen Cannon, seems to think there's, you know, a problem with a recurring pattern of physical threats for anybody who comes into adverse contact with Trump. And last thought, this is absurd. I get the judges want to make this appeal proof or reduce the risk, but there is no other person in America facing criminal trials at a federal or state level who could get away with this. It's simply, it in my more than 20 years of working law enforcement and going to trials and watching pretrial back and forth between defendants and the government and courts, never, ever was anything close to this ever out there. The slightest sort of like raised eyebrow about the judge would get you smacked down so hard it'd make your head spin, unless your name is Donald Trump. And then we keep saying, you know, oh, it's a matter of time before he faces sanctions. Well, he hadn't really yet, but, you know, we'll see if he does in this case, because again, looking at, you know, his postings on Truth Social this morning, he, I think, posted a, you know, a link to a video that still continues to talk about Merchan's daughter. And so it's like, all right, you're now fucked around. So let's find out what happens.
Yeah. And I agree. I agree with that, that this, if, you know, if we're anyone else, I just wanted to raise the common theme I've seen in all of these filings, all of these rulings on limited gag orders, the one in DC that went up through the DC Circuit Court of Appeals, which had to be modified, and more narrowly tailored. It just seems that every jurist that has anything to do with any kind of limited gag order on Donald Trump is being extremely cautious about his speech as a presidential candidate, which cuts at and goes against, by the way, Pete, the core tenet of all of the arguments in all of these jurisdictions put forth by the government that no president, no man, regardless of his position, is above the law. It's hard to read that being one of the core arguments for everything that's happening with these prosecutions. No man is above the law. Presidents aren't kings, etc. But then to give him this huge deference in his ability to attack potential witnesses. We had him go after Cassidy Hutchinson recently on Truth Social. And we haven't heard a peep from Jack Smith on the limited gag order about going after witnesses in the DC trial. But it's everybody. Everybody is making what I see as this mistake, that they are really giving him a lot of runway to be able to do this and to be able to behave this way because he's running for president. But again, when your core argument is that no man is above the law, those two things don't, you know, they're at odds.
Yeah. And there's not, these are not hypothetical concerns. I mean, there is a rich pattern of fact of Trump mentioning somebody in a threatening way and those people then receiving physical threats, online threats, being swatted, you know, having people charged for doing it. So this is not some like, oh, well, gosh, if you say something, it's going to potentially put these people in danger. It's like, no, it has, in fact, put people in danger. Not once, yeah. Not twice, not a few times, but literally dozens of times.
Well, DOJ has convicted, just I think in Arizona, 13 out of 20 cases that are, 7 are still ongoing for attacking election workers. You know, I mean, there's so much evidence. Jack Smith filed evidence with, you know, with the court down in Florida, you know, as part of don't release the witness names. And he had to put those under seal and he had to put that evidence under seal because it's currently under criminal federal investigation for people attacking these witnesses. And of course, Judge Cannon said, well, I've looked at it and I don't think it should be ex parte. I'm giving it to Donald Trump. So it's ongoing. It's obvious. It's clear. There's tons of evidence. There's been convictions. There are open criminal and ongoing criminal investigations into these attacks. Yet here we are. It's frustrating. Right.
It is super frustrating. And I suspect I know what the line is. Somebody is going to have to die, not just get beat up. Somebody, you know, because we already had Paul Pelosi, right? We already had him attacked near death. Again, think about how much data there is out there about this. It is, I'm afraid, going to take somebody dying before people all of a sudden say, whoa, hey, wait, this is not a hypothetical, even though we should have known it's not been a hypothetical for years now. It reminds me of the response every time there is a mass shooting somewhere. It's like, no, there's an easy answer. Sensible gun control is the easy answer. Get assault weapons off the streets and we will greatly decrease the number of mass shootings out there. But everybody wants to put their head in the sand. I feel I get the same feeling of judicial head in the sand when it comes to trying to control Donald Trump. And the way you do it is twofold, either hit him with money or throw him in jail. And those are the only two things that are going to stop this sort of behavior. But, you know,
yeah.
I feel like I'm...
Yeah. And I hope they're also not worried that throwing him in jail will make him more popular. And that's why they're not doing it, because that's a political consideration. And those should be left at the door when we're talking about applying the law equally to everyone. You know, I don't even know if death will do it, because several people died on January 6th, Pete. And that was due to his rhetoric. And so,
Mike Johnson just said they were protesting and just happened to wander in and find themselves there. They're
well, you know. I know it was a peaceful protest and yeah.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
All right. We have a lot more to get to this show, but we do have to take a quick break. Everybody stick around. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is John Cryer, and I am hosting a new 7-part true crime podcast called Lawyers, Guns, and Money. That'll challenge everything you think you know about U.S. covert operations and presidential misconduct. From Jack Bryan, the director of American PSYOP, comes the incredible true story of John Mattis, a newly sworn-in Miami public defender in the 1980s who has found himself completely in over his head.
I step off the plane, and there is a van with a couple guys with Uzis. And one of them in broken English said, "Welcome to Bogota, John."
Mattis's first felony defendant has been arrested for having a machine gun and tells Mattis a dangerous secret.
He was shipping arms into Central America on behalf of the CIA. As a first-time lawyer, I want to act like I know what I'm doing.
But with the help of a Colombian drug smuggler...
How much money the CIA raised by hitting up drug dealers?
A lot of money, millions of dollars.
An Alabama mercenary...
They were prepared to die to the last man. I saw this in them. I saw the fire in their eyes. And they made me their war chief.
And a newly elected senator, John Kerry.
We are looking at allegations of drug running, gun smuggling, conspiracy to commit murder, and murder itself.
He'll fight to free his client
the judge said, show me in a courtroom how we were at war.
Expose an illegal war being run by the White House.
I mean, I wanted him involved, but I didn't want to be on record as doing it.
And somehow stay alive in the process.
I just escaped a kidnapping by the CIA in Costa Rica.
This is Lawyers, Guns, and Money.
So you have a man in an Armani suit standing in the bow of a boat with a rocket launcher and says, if I lose sight of you, I will launch. You will be vaporized.
Available everywhere starting October 29th, or get it ad-free and early starting October 22nd at lawyersgunsandmoney.supercast.com. There you'll find bonus episodes along with exclusive content. Subscribe now.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. We have more patrons to thank. Emily, Tim Countess, Jacqueline Griggs, Isaac Boyle, Becky Worrell, Allison Harold, Miss Trix, Jeannie, and Cheryl. Thank all of you so much. Thank you for being such key partners in putting this together and letting us get all this information to you. Simply couldn't do it without you, and really, really thank all of you for your support. So with that, let's go down to Washington, D.C., and Jeffrey Clark's disbarment hearing from the D.C. Bar. This is from Kyle Chaney at Politico, and talking about former White House Deputy Counsel Patrick Philbin, saying it was Philbin's first public testimony about the chaotic final days of the Trump presidency since he left the White House. Though Philbin has spoken to both the January 6th Select Committee and the federal grand jury that indicted Trump for his efforts to seize a second term, no transcript or recording of his remarks have ever been released. Philbin's description of his interactions with Clark shed new light on the frenzied effort by Trump to remake the Justice Department into a tool of his bid to cling to power despite losing the election. A remarkable new account more than 3 years after a mob of pro-Trump rioters stormed the Capitol in his name. His testimony, Philbin's testimony, followed Richard Donahue, a former acting deputy attorney general. Together, the two men described a White House that had let down all guardrails, with conspiracy theories about election fraud reaching Trump, who is an eager recipient of even implausible claims of fraud. Clark, too, embraced some of those claims, they said.
You know what's funny? They say a White House that had let down all the guardrails. No, that's what we would see in a second Trump term. There
right.
were clearly a few guardrails up because most of the DOJ was like, no, we're all going to quit if you put Jeffrey Clark in charge here. So I don't know that I would characterize this as a White House that had
completely
let down
agree.
All the guardrails. But
completely agree. And that's like everybody saying, oh, well, democracy held. It's like, barely.
Barely. And at like 19 points.
Right. I mean, I've used the analogy of it's not like somebody like, oh, I broke my arm. It's like, no, somebody was lying on the ER table with no pulse and like a team of physicians, you know, with paddles trying
flatliners.
To resuscitate. Right. Flatlined yeah. and trying to resuscitate democracy. It was not like, oh, democracy survived. Democracy was dead and brought back to life through the like miraculous work of a large number of people. So no, I'd
19. Yeah,
agree
like
with
it
you.
Wasn't just
completely
one
agree.
Point of a thread hanging on. There were like 19 points of failure, and they all of them had to come back from the dead. It was amazing.
Yeah, totally agree. And look, I mean, you know, Patrick, I a lot of these people who are the guardrails, are hardly heroes, but they did, you know, serve as a guardrails. And, you know, in point of fact, Philbin, this is back to the Politico article, Philbin described feeling relief in the first days of January 2021 when he heard that Trump had ditched plans to appoint Trump as acting attorney general. But
you mean Clark?
Clark. Yes. Sorry. Clark
yeah.
is acting attorney general. He, Philbin, quickly learned in discussions with his boss, Pat Cipollone, and two top DOJ officials, the acting attorney general, Jeff Rosen, and his deputy, Richard Donahue, that the effort had been revived. The men agreed that Philbin should speak to Clark owing to their decades-long relationship and attempt to discern what was happening. To Philbin, who testified for about 2 hours last Tuesday, described Clark as wildly misinformed about claims of election fraud, countenancing a theory about smart thermostats, not making this up, smart thermostats being used to manipulate voting machines, and not sufficiently cognizant of the havoc it would wreak on the country if his plan succeeded. But he said Clark seemed, quote, 100% sincere, unquote, in his beliefs. Continuing, quote, I believe that he felt he essentially had a duty, Philbin said. I think Jeff's view was that there was a real crisis in the country and that he was being given an opportunity to do something about it, unquote. When Philbin warned Clark,
odd to me. I feel like he knew that it was full of shit because 10,000 people told him.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, and that's going to be key to some of the charges against him is like, you know, mm-hmm. what was his state of mind and whether or not he believed it or not. But there is an element of like craziness to Clark, and that's what you're seeing in, you know, some of this Philbin testimony. You know, but to the point of the ruthless cold-bloodedness of it, this is the, you know, again, Gerstein again, when Philbin warned Clark that there would be riots in every major American city if Trump reversed the outcome of the election, Clark responded, quote, "Well, Pat, that's what the Insurrection Act is for," unquote, Philbin recalled. Wow. Clark, in Philbin's telling, was referring to a 19th century federal law that permits the president to use the military to quell civil unrest, an indication that he recognized the grave implications of his efforts. Though it was Philbin's first time publicly discussing the exchange, the conversation was captured in Special Counsel Jack Smith's indictment of Trump, without naming either Philbin or Clark, though the identities of both speakers were easily discerned. On Tuesday, Philbin was asked to elaborate on this discussion. Quote, "I don't think I said anything on the phone. I just thought that that showed a lack of judgment," he said. "Triggering riots in every major city in America, you've got to be really sure about what you're doing and have no alternatives. In my estimation, that was not the sort of situation we were talking about," unquote.
Wow. Yeah, now, Philbin was the second witness to testify, like you said, in this disciplinary proceeding, which could result in Clark being disbarred. Barr investigators have charged him with attempting to coerce the DOJ leaders to embrace false claims of election fraud in order to pressure state legislators to consider reversing Trump's defeat in Georgia and other swing states. Now, Trump, fuming at his DOJ leadership for what he contended was a failure to pursue fraud investigations, repeatedly flirted with appointing Clark as their leader. And it says here, ultimately backed down amid a mass resignation threat. But we now have evidence that he actually was the acting attorney general, Jeff Clark was, for a few hours on January 3rd. Now, Clark has since been charged alongside Trump in Georgia, as we know, for their efforts to overturn the election. Clark was identified by Jack Smith also, as we know, as a co-conspirator in the Washington, D.C. case. And Andy and I have talked about, you know, why hasn't Jack Smith indicted everybody else, members of Congress, unindicted co-conspirators. And we've concluded after speaking to multiple experts, the consensus seems to be that if you indict all those other people, then all of those other people will file motions to consolidate with Trump and then kind of latch onto his case and drag it down. And nobody will go to trial until probably late next year. So that's sort of why it's just Trump out there on his own, just four counts, because that case was supposed to be built for speed until the Supreme Court got a hold of it. Now, Philbin said the mass resignation that caused Trump to back down from Clark's appointment was partially his idea. He recalled that a similar mass resignation threat from his days as a lawyer in the G.W. Bush administration over warrantless wiretapping had similarly affected policy decisions. So he said he advised Rosen to take the temperature of the DOJ leadership about how they would react if Trump appointed Clark as acting attorney general. Pretty much every top DOJ official said, "I'm out, I would resign." A significant factor that caused Trump to back off his plan. So go take the temperature. I like how Pete, they were like, "We're not sure how the rest of the DOJ might react." They were like, "No, we're out. We're out if he does that." I mean, it was overwhelming. Quote, "We talked about some of the theories of fraud that were around. They'd been debunked and there wasn't really anything there. This is Philbin. And he goes on to say, if the president made him acting attorney general, people at DOJ would resign. There's going to be just a massive wave of resignations. People weren't going to be following him to pursue these theories of fraud. Now, Philbin said he was among those who would have resigned as well. Quote, "I was not on a course of action that I could countenance," he said. "I thought there was not a justification for it. It was a sufficiently bad idea, an unjustified interference with the completion of the Electoral College count. I wouldn't want to be there in the White House any longer participating in that." So that is the long and the short of what's going on in Clark's disbarment hearing. I imagine, much like Eastman, who we'll talk about in a minute, that the judge here will recommend he be disbarred as well.
Yeah, and, you know, it does move slowly, and I think we're getting the right result. I still look forward to Sidney Powell, who, you know, and there's a pattern of stuff. Like, you know, there was this mid-December 2020 meeting in the White House where, you know, they discussed Sidney Powell becoming special counsel, but it actually sounds like, in retrospect, Trump actually made her special counsel to look into election interference for a couple hours until Meadows or somebody else, you know, sort of rescinded or walked back the order. So a lot of the things that people said, oh, it could have happened, it's starting to look like a lot of things did happen. And the, you know, final thought for me on all of this, these threats of mass resignations, that, oh, it worked back during the warrantless surveillance program under George W. Bush, and that worked here with Trump. You know when it's not going to work? It's not going to work in the next Trump administration. If you get a bunch of career people saying, oh, we're going to resign, there, you're going to get a bunch of people saying, great, we have our list from Project 2025. We have any number of people ready to replace you. There is no longer going to be a deterrent effect by some well-meaning person saying, I can't countenance this, I'm going to resign. They may, you know, people may do that for personal moral reasons, but any sort of calculation of like, my resigning has the power to stop something, I think is out the window next administration.
It totally is. That's the whole point of Project 2025. And it's to preempt anything like that. It's to remove the guardrails as soon as you get into the White House. I mean, they're already recruiting people loyal to Trump and MAGA for those government positions. The first day he gets into office, Schedule F, he fires everybody he doesn't like, pretty much everybody, probably everyone, and then just replaces everybody with a very skeleton, bare bones operation of his sycophants and yes men and women. And that'll be it. That'll be the end of it. So when, you know, Kyle Cheney says all the guardrails were off, I think there were a lot of guardrails in the name of civil servants that were still working in these agencies. And those folks will no longer be there. The adults in the room, as they call them. All right. And that's the most frightening thing about Project 2025 and a second Trump term, honestly. And then there would be no future elections. But we could talk about that forever. But we have more news we have to get to. But we do have to take a quick break. So everybody stick around. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is John Cryer, and I am hosting a new 7-part true crime podcast called Lawyers, Guns, and Money that'll challenge everything you think you know about U.S. covert operations and presidential misconduct. From Jack Bryan, the director of American PSYOP, comes the incredible true story of John Mattis, a newly sworn-in Miami public defender in the 1980s who has found himself completely in over his head.
I step off the plane, and there is a van with a couple guys with Uzis. And one of them in broken English said, "Welcome to Bogota, John."
Mattis's first felony defendant has been arrested for having a machine gun and tells Mattis a dangerous secret.
He was shipping arms into Central America on behalf of the CIA. As a first-time lawyer, I want to act like I know what I'm doing.
But with the help of a Colombian drug smuggler,
how much money the CIA raised by hitting up drug dealers?
A lot of money, millions of dollars.
An Alabama mercenary.
They were prepared to die to the last man. I saw this in them. I saw the fire in their eyes. And they made me their war chief.
And a newly elected senator, John Kerry.
We are looking at allegations of drug running, gun smuggling, conspiracy to commit murder and murder itself.
He'll fight to free his client.
The judge said, show me, in a courtroom, how we were at war.
Expose an illegal war being run by the White House.
I mean, I wanted him involved, but I didn't want to be on record as doing it.
And somehow stay alive in the process.
I just escaped a kidnapping by the CIA in Costa Rica.
This is Lawyers, Guns, and Money.
So you have a man in an Armani suit standing on the bow of a boat with a rocket launcher and says, if I lose sight of you, I will launch. You will be vaporized.
Available everywhere starting October 29th, or get it ad-free and early starting October 22nd at lawyersgunsandmoney.supercast.com. There you'll find bonus episodes along with exclusive content. Subscribe now.
Hey, everybody, welcome back. We have more new patrons to thank, including Nancy, Patrice Sheets. Thanks for what you do. You're welcome. Lisa Schlosser. Let's see. Cuck Tucker Carlson. Andrea Jones, Boxer Mom, NorCal Gal, Marsha Reynolds, Susan Jaffe. You are amazing. Thank you so much for supporting independent media. And me and Pete, we appreciate you. All right, Pete, let's stay with the disbarment theme and talk about the judge's ruling recommending John Eastman be disbarred. The judge spent the first 75 pages of her ruling explaining why Eastman's claims of election fraud were based on data that he did or should have known were unreliable with minimal due diligence. If he had just Googled some of this, he would have at least applied a little bit of due diligence. This is why, by the way, when we did the big sanctions hearing up in Michigan with the crack and strike force, all of these pleadings, you know, the Melissa Carones of the world, the people saying, you know, I saw all these boxes of ballots that were being transported, all those affidavits, none of them were verified by any of these lawyers. And it is your job as a lawyer to apply a little bit of due diligence to make sure the pleadings that you're making to the court aren't full of shit, basically. And so they actually had to, as part of their sanctions, they had to take classes to refresh themselves on how to file proper pleadings and do minimal due diligence to ensure that they were not full of garbage. So here is what the judge says. In this contested disciplinary proceeding, the official of Chief Trial Counsel of the State Bar of California, that's OCTC, charged John Charles Eastman with 11 counts of misconduct arising from certain activities surrounding his representation of former President Donald Trump and the 2020 presidential election. Eastman is charged with one count of failing to support the Constitution and laws of the United States, two counts of seeking to mislead the court, six counts of moral turpitude by making various misrepresentations. Those are the pleadings I was telling you about. And two additional counts of moral turpitude. The court finds that the OCTC has satisfied its burden of proving all the charges except for count 11, which the court dismisses with prejudice, meaning it can't be brought back up again. The one count they were unable to prove was that Eastman's speech at the Ellipse on January 6th incited the crowd. That's the one. Now they say in view, and by the way, everyone who's like upset that Jack Smith didn't charge Donald Trump with inciting an insurrection, you know, so that he could, you know, because I think Title 18 U.S. Code 2383 insurrection, that would, I think there's something in the law that says you can't run for office again. I think that would lose in court, but everyone's like, you know, the DOJ made a mistake by not charging this because we wouldn't have had to deal with the 14th Amendment, Section 3 of the 14th Amendment thing. I disagree with that. I think that even, first of all, if he were charged and convicted with insurrection, I don't think the Supreme Court would have used that as a preclusion from running for office. I think they would have said, well, Congress will need to write it up, because that's what they said in this order. But most importantly here, the judge found that even Eastman didn't incite the crowd. It's so hard to prove. It's so hard to prove incitement and or insurrection. So I take this as a signal that it might have been a good idea to not bring that charge into the mix in the January 6th case. In view of the circumstances surrounding Eastman's misconduct and balancing the aggravation and mitigation, the court recommends Eastman be disbarred. Now, the judge first addresses Texas v. Pennsylvania. These are the first 75 pages. I'm going to sum them up as best I can. Texas v. Pennsylvania. That's how Trump retained Eastman to be his lawyer for that, as candidate for president for post-election litigation purposes and matters related to the Electoral College. And again, I think, Pete, that's going to be important to the immunity hearing at the Supreme Court for the D.C. trial, because Trump is arguing that his lies were within the outer perimeter of his job. But I think that Jack Smith and the DOJ, in their filings to Judge Chutkan and the D.C. Circuit and to the Supreme Court, they talk about how Trump was a candidate for office when he did all that. So you'll recall that Trump filed as an interested party a motion to intervene in Texas v. Pennsylvania, and he called himself a candidate for president. That's what gave him jurisdiction, or standing, I should say, to file as an intervening party. I'm a candidate for president. So he says he's a candidate, but he's arguing elsewhere that he was acting as a sitting president. And that indicated his role in the fraudulent elector scheme and Pence pressure campaign whereas a candidate. And again, that makes his immunity bid pretty difficult to argue. Eastman filed that for Trump. And the court notes that before filing a motion to intervene, Eastman reviewed the entire motion for leave and bill of complaint, which Eastman did not analyze or even seek the assistance of an expert to evaluate. Without explanation or support for any partisan malfeasance regarding the Georgia absentee ballots, Eastman also argued in the intervening motion, this is the Trump motion where he says he's a candidate, that an unconstitutional change in Georgia law appeared to materially benefit Biden. However, Eastman confided in his longtime friend, attorney Cleta Mitchell, on November 29, 2020, that Eastman knew there was no actual evidence of outcome determinative fraud in the 2020 presidential election in any of the defendant states, even though the statistical analysis he was aware of, a number of which were cited in Texas v. Pennsylvania, may draw that conclusion. So here's the judge saying, you knew this was all bullshit, but you put it in a pleading to the court. And that's sanctionable. And I think you should be disbarred. Around the same time that Texas v. Pennsylvania was being litigated, Eastman got involved in several other election challenges to the results in Georgia, including Trump v. Raffensperger and Trump v. Kemp. And they were full of unsubstantiated and unverified assertions of fraud, including the State Farm Arena video. That's the one with Ruby Freeman and Shea Moss. That Georgia election officials allowed unqualified people to vote, including felons still in prison, underage people, dead people, unregistered people, people from different counties voting across county lines, non-residents voting. So this is all explained in that first 75 pages, Pete. It goes on to discuss his fraudulent elector memos, his work for Trump on that scheme, as well as his appearance on Bannon's War Room, where he asked listeners to pressure the swing state legislators to abandon the Biden electors, even though he knew that all of these numbers that he put in this pleading, Texas v. Pennsylvania, Trump v. Raffensperger, Trump v. Kemp, were false.
Yeah, and so all of this is leading up to the conclusions, right? This is laying out the facts and the pattern of behavior. And then the judge gets around to saying, after laying all that out, quote, John Eastman's wrongdoing in 2020 was so extensive, his refusal to accept responsibility so pervasive, that the only remedy is disbarment. The evidence clearly and convincingly proves that Eastman and President Trump entered into an agreement to obstruct the joint session of Congress by unlawfully having Vice President Pence reject or delay the counting of electoral votes on January 6, 2021. Specifically, on December 23, 2020, and January 3rd, 2021, respectively, Eastman wrote two-page and six-page memos outlining a detailed plan of action for Vice President Pence to declare President Trump the re-elected president. On January 2nd, Eastman appeared on the Bannon War Room and publicly spoke about the illegal conduct of the 2020 presidential election and claimed that more than enough fraud had occurred to affect the outcome of the election. Although Roland's decision, you know, this is backing out of what the court wrote, although Roland's decision is a recommendation to the state Supreme Court, it automatically triggers a process to put Eastman on inactive status as an attorney, prohibiting him from practicing law. That inactive status for Eastman takes effect in 3 days, so it's in effect now, and it remains in effect until the Supreme Court either affirms his disbarment or orders a different penalty. Though Eastman cannot practice law anymore, he is not technically disbarred yet. This is the start of a process leading to the California Supreme Court. Eastman can and almost certainly will appeal Roland's ruling. And Eastman has filed that he plans to appeal, arguing that it's not fair that he should face criminal trial in Fulton County without being able to practice law and make money to pay his legal bills. So sad how alleged illegal activities impact your ability to earn a living. You know what this, Allison? You know, I was
pull yourself up by your bootstraps, buddy. Yeah, get a job at McDonald's.
This you know what it reminded me? He talked about his refusal to accept responsibility being so pervasive. I'm like, why? You know what that reminds me of? It reminds me of Judge Ngoren writing about Trump. Talking when he says, you know, starting with
pathological.
This, right. The English poet Alexander Pope, 1688-1744, first declared, quote, to err is human, to forgive is divine, unquote. Defendants apparently are of a different mind. After some 4 years of investigation and litigation, the only error, inadvertent, of course, that they acknowledged is the tripling of the size of the Trump Tower penthouse, which cannot be gainsaid. Their complete lack of contrition and remorse borders on pathological. And then continuing on saying defendants are incapable of admitting the error of their ways. This is all of these people. It is just, it is, again, and people not only saying they're like incapable of saying, sorry, I was wrong. People talking about it being pathological, about it being pervasive. This is not just something when, you know, you get in a fight with your significant other and you know you're wrong and you don't want to say you're wrong. It's not that. You have judges saying this is a pathological behavior. It is a pervasive behavior. And not just one. It's Eastman. It's Trump. It's Eric. It's Don. It's this entire universe. And goddamn, it's Pete Navarro holding press conferences across the street before he walks into the lockup. This privileged, mediocre white men unable to say, I screwed up. It's remarkable. And it's just, there's something to that that I think is, I don't know if it's like attracting like, I don't know if it's, I don't know what it is, but it is.
Darvo, it's abusive narcissism, you know, and I mean, it's, and it's funny, Pete, because as soon as you mentioned that, I was like, oh, the pathological line. And my new pop culture references are no longer movie lines. They are now lines that I remember that stand out in judge
from various
rulings.
Judges around the United States.
This is
talking
my
about
new,
Trump
this
and
is,
Trumpism.
This is my new pop culture because I knew exactly what you were talking about. Because, yeah, it is pervasive. And it's, you know, it's their inability to be sorry. They try to turn around and say, well, I truly believed that. But he told Cleta Mitchell, oh, no, there's not outcome determinative election fraud. And then turns around and files these pleadings in, you know, Trump v. Kemp, Trump v. Raffensperger, Texas v. Pennsylvania, the intervening motion for Trump as a candidate saying, oh, yeah. And I think there's even an email that we learned from the Eastman emails where somebody recommends, and it might have been Eastman or it might have been Chesbrough, where somebody recommends, like, I've looked at your filing here in Texas v. Pennsylvania, and we now have proof that these numbers are not correct. So I don't recommend that President Trump signed this intervention, this motion to intervene as a candidate for president in your lawsuit, Mr. Eastman, because we now have evidence that these numbers are incorrect. And it could have been, remember the two reports that the Trump campaign paid $1.5 million for from research firms looking for voter fraud, and they both came back and said there's none. You know, I think maybe they got to look at those reports and told Eastman, like, I don't think Trump should sign this. But then Trump went ahead and signed it.
Yep. So
it's all there.
100%.
All right. We still have quite a few more stories to get to, but we have to take one more quick break. Everybody stick around. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is John Cryer, and I am hosting a new 7-part true crime podcast called Lawyers, Guns, and Money that'll challenge everything you think you know about U.S. covert operations and presidential misconduct. From Jack Bryan, the director of American PSYOP, comes the incredible true story of John Mattis, a newly sworn-in Miami public defender in the 1980s who has found himself completely in over his head.
I step off the plane, and there is a van with a couple guys with Uzis. And one of them in broken English said, "Welcome to Bogota, John."
Mattis's first felony defendant has been arrested for having a machine gun and tells Mattis a dangerous secret.
He was shipping arms into Central America on behalf of the CIA. As a first-time lawyer, I want to act like I know what I'm doing.
But with the help of a Colombian drug smuggler...
How much money the CIA raised by hitting up drug dealers?
A lot of money. Millions of dollars.
An Alabama mercenary...
They were prepared to die to the last man. I saw this in them. I saw the fire in their eyes. And they made me their war chief.
And a newly elected senator, John Kerry...
We are looking at allegations of drug running, gun smuggling, conspiracy to commit murder and murder itself.
He'll fight to free his client.
The judge said, show me in a courtroom how we were at war.
Expose an illegal war being run by the White House.
I mean, I wanted him involved, but I didn't want to be on record as doing it.
And somehow stay alive in the process.
I just escaped a kidnapping by the CIA in Costa Rica.
This is Lawyers, Guns, and Money.
So you have a man in an Armani suit standing in the bow of a boat with a rocket launcher and says, "If I lose sight of you, I will launch. You will be vaporized."
Available everywhere starting October 29th, or get it ad-free and early starting October 22nd at lawyersgunsandmoney.supercast.com. There you'll find bonus episodes along with exclusive content. Subscribe now.
Hey, welcome back. A few more things to go through, but first, some more patrons to thank. I joined for Pete's Cussing. Thank you. Ellen Swaim, N. Fulmer, Louis Lewister, Baby Badness, Robert Farr, Molly Dunn, Just Askin L.A., DeAndre, and Viola DeGamba. Thank all of you so much for your support, for making this possible. Really, really appreciate your support. So, we have a few more stories to report. First, from CNN, a former Trump 2020 campaign official has been subpoenaed by officials in Arizona as part of the criminal investigation focused on efforts to overturn Joe Biden's win, according to two sources familiar with the matter. Sources told CNN that Arizona Attorney General Chris Mays is nearing a decision on whether to bring criminal charges. Among those who have been interviewed by Arizona prosecutors in recent months is pro-Trump attorney Kenneth Chesbro. Now, communications previously obtained by CNN and handed over to prosecutors in multiple states investigating efforts to overturn the 2020 election show Chesbro worked closely with Mike Roman on the fake electors plot in the lead up to the January 6, 2021 Capitol riot. Now, the thing is, Roman's lawyers told the prosecutors he was going to plead the fifth, but they called him in anyway. Some legal experts say that's normally not done because pleading the fifth can bias the grand jury, giving the defendant a small glimmer of hope on appeal. But, you know, interesting that we'll see if there are charges coming out of Arizona, and if so, how broadly they go. If it's, you know, like, if you think to the Michigan charges, most, if not all of those, I think, are Michigan figures, right? There are people in the
Michigan
Republican
Party.
And the question is, do any of these states at some point do what Georgia did and actually start looking to the figures who were involved at a national level? I hope they do, but we'll see.
Yeah, we will see. And if you're wondering, like, why Michigan indicted last year, and by the way, the first to indict anybody involved in the coup was Michigan Attorney General Dana Nessel, and why Arizona is just now getting to this point of getting close to making charging decisions, I just want to remind everybody that the Arizona elections in 2022 brought in Attorney General Chris Mays, Katie Hobbs. You know, these folks didn't get into office until 2023, replacing the old Republican Attorney General and the old governor. And so, not that the governor has anything to do with this, it's just that's, you know, I'm using that as a pinpoint, a pin in the map for when the election happened. So everyone goes, oh yeah, I remember when Katie Hobbs won. It wasn't in 2020. It was 2 years later. And so that's why they're 2 years behind everybody else. So just wanted to bring that to everybody's attention and remind them in case everyone's like, why is Arizona taking so long? They just had gotten there. So, and they only, they, I mean, they got there in January 2023, Pete, and the Attorney General in Arizona put together a prosecutorial team to investigate the fraudulent elector scheme in May after she was only there for 5 months. So that's pretty fast. All right, down to Fulton County. CBS News is reporting that 2 weeks after Fani Willis survived a bid by defense lawyers to have her disqualified, she has all but taken over the case personally, focusing intensely on legal strategy and getting her team in fighting form for trial. That's how CBS puts it. In a significant move along these lines, according to a source close to her, Willis has decided to play a leading courtroom role herself in the sprawling conspiracy case against Donald Trump and his 14 co-defendants. Quote, "I think there are efforts to slow down this train, but the train is coming," she said. That's what she said with her characteristic bravado during impromptu remarks to CNN as she was leaving a Georgia Easter egg hunt on March 23rd. "I guess my greatest crime is that I had a relationship with a man, but that's not something I find embarrassing in any way," she added. So that she's going to be, I guess, she's going to have a prominent role in this trial, which will be fully televised whenever it happens. It could be a while.
Yeah. And so in the pivoting to the Hunter Biden tax case, this from the LA Times, lawyers for Hunter Biden asked a federal judge in Los Angeles to throw out 9 tax-related charges, arguing that the president's son is being vindictively prosecuted by the Justice Department and had his rights trampled by two IRS agents who publicly revealed his confidential tax records. At a hearing on Wednesday, U.S. District Judge Mark C. Scarsi appeared skeptical about Biden's 8 motions to dismiss the criminal charges, pointing out that his lawyers had little evidence to bolster some of their arguments. Scarsi, an appointee of Donald Trump, said he would rule on the motions by April 17th. Biden did not attend the hearing. Led by Abby Lowell, Biden's legal team contended that intense political pressure from Republican lawmakers and former President Trump had improperly influenced the case, led to the collapse of a plea deal for Biden, and prompted prosecutors to up the ante and secure far more serious indictments in both Delaware and Los Angeles. Quote, "Is there any evidence that pressure from any outside entity influenced the prosecution team?" the judge asked Lowell on Wednesday. "There really is no evidence. You cite to things on the internet," the judge said at another point. Lowell stressed that a timeline of events showed how prosecutors were improperly influenced, one example being the summoning of Special Counsel David Weiss to testify before Congress. Quote, "It's a timeline, but it's a juicy timeline," Lowell said.
Yeah, that's Abby Lowell, as we know, famously Jared Kushner's lawyer, but now representing Hunter Biden. And this just in, breaking news, the judge has denied all 9 Hunter Biden motions. I thought April 17th, he said.
17-2, it's the anti-canon.
I see. And quite so, right? Marcy Wheeler writes on her blog, emptywheel.net, "As expected, Judge Scarsi has denied Hunter Biden's motion to dismiss. But Marcy says there's multiple problems with the interpretation of the plea agreement, the diversion agreement, right? Now, you'll remember that whole thing kind of blew up because Hunter Biden and his lawyers were in court and Judge Noriko was like, well, so you still might bring other charges? Did you know that, Mr. Biden and your lawyer, Mr. Lowell, did you know? And they were like, no, we didn't know that. If that's the case, we're not doing this. So that, you know, that kind of whole thing, that thing blew up. And that's when Jordan and Comer and Trump got really mad, right, about the plea agreement. And it is Abby Lowell and Hunter Biden's contention that that's that public pressure from, you know, the Republicans in Congress and Donald Trump is what caused Weiss to go back and actually indict him and ask, you know, ask to be a special counsel and indict Hunter Biden. But the judge wasn't buying it, said you don't have any evidence. But the problems with the interpretation of the diversion agreement and his invitation for additional briefing on what he calls, the judge even says, it's a Schrodinger's cat-esque construction of defendant's immunity under the diversion agreement. So he agrees that the diversion agreement thing was messed up, but still says that the motion to dismiss the charges is denied. Marcy says the judge's errors undermine his otherwise totally defensible decision on Hunter's motion for vindictive and selective prosecution. And she notes that Scarsi here in the tax case is moving at a blistering pace. Like you said, the anti-canon schedule. Scarsi issued the ruling a full 16 days before he said he would, and well before Judge Norica had ruled on similar motions in Hunter's gun case. And that's interesting because Hunter had asked Scarsi to wait until Judge Norica ruled on the diversion agreement, but he didn't. And that could make Scarsi's ruling more susceptible to appeal, according to Marcy. She says Scarsi ruled that the parties to the contract granting Hunter Biden immunity from this prosecution executed the agreement, but did not yet put it into effect. Mm-hmm. As he describes, quote, "The diversion agreement is a binding contract, but performance of its terms is not yet required," unquote. So that's how he gets out of the diversion agreement argument. And Marcy disagrees. And you're going to want to read her blog at emptywheel.net because she says there are 3 mistakes with regard to the diversion agreement that this judge, Judge Scarsi, made. And it seems like wanting to go ahead of Norica, because maybe Norica is more seriously thinking about how this diversion agreement impacts potential immunity for Hunter Biden, because she's the one who called it out in court in the first place. She's the one who said, I don't think the prosecution is telling you what it's telling you, basically. Like, I think you're still susceptible to something like a FARA charge, I believe she said. And when the Bidens found out about that, I was like, back out, don't sign that thing, get out of there, screw that agreement, and you know, sue, which they did in another case. But here we are now, this judge in the tax case, which came after the gun case, is now deciding on these motions before the gun case judge is. So that, and Marcy, like I said, read her blog, because she is going to lay out the three errors and how this makes vulnerable this particular judge's decision on these motions. But she did say otherwise, Pete, like, the you know, totally defensible decision on the motion for a vindictive and selective prosecution. But some of the timing is weird, and there were some things that were left out.
Yeah, and I think it's critical that, you know, the judge did find that the diversion agreement is a binding contract. I'm not quite sure how he, and I'll go read the decision and certainly want to see what Marcy has to say about the performance of its terms are not yet required because it hasn't been put into effect. If it's a binding contract, I don't know how you get around that in ways so favorable to the government, but we'll see what they have to say. But, you know, it seems to me that's a fairly important finding by the mm-hmm. judge. And also in the category of breaking news, Donald Trump posted his $175 million bond. Now, make of this what you will. It's being underwritten by Don Hankey, the king of the subprime car loan. Literally, his father was a used car dealer. And then Hankey took over the business and turned it into a massive, you know, car loans for, you know, people who have tough times with credit.
Oh, the predatory car loan thing.
Yes, every payday as a young lieutenant, I would get calls from people like this trying to say, why your private signed this thing and is, you know, in debt and missed his payment and we want to garnish his wages. And you take a look at the loan and it's like, you know, some obscene interest rate. But yes, predatory lenders. Again, much like a lot of the Trump supporters, people donating $5, $10, buying a $2,000 used car worth probably $1,200 who can't afford it regardless, who are still giving money for Donald Trump's legal defense, who are giving money for Alina Haba to go on luxury birthday vacations down in the Caribbean.
Pete, I had one of these loans when I was in the Navy.
Yes.
There were these loan sharks parked right outside of the base.
Absolutely.
And I had like a 24.9% interest rate on a car because, you know, you don't have rent. And so they come after you. That's this subprime car loan guy.
Yes.
Mr. Hankey, the yes. Christmas poo.
Now worth billions and now underwriting Donald Trump. Now, he's also the largest shareholder in Axos Bank, by the way, which happens, make this what you will, which happens to have lent Trump $225 million on both Trump Tower and Doral. Loans are both which come due in 2032. And now, so, you know, what we're seeing here, people like this, people like, remember Jeffrey Yass, the guy who has all this money invested in ByteDance, the parent company of TikTok, who happened to give, you know, and is one of the largest shareholders of the True Social and whatever the new name for that is. This is the emergence of the oligarchs in America, right? There have always been captains yep. of industry. There have always been, you know, the Rockefellers and folks who, you know, were in the Carnegies, you know, wealthy, wealthy industrialists. But this personal, rather than people just wielding political power through their industrial might, we're seeing the emergence of people who are paying money directly to someone to support or defend their corruption.
Yeah.
And this is, these people are no different, in my opinion, from Oleg Deripaska. They are
no different
from any number of corrupt oligarchs who are like, shelter me, give me preferential treatment, give me the opportunity to extract rents off the backs of, in many cases, people the least able to afford it. And in exchange, I will give you money to prop up your bullshit social media business, to get your, you know, your reduced bond that you have to pay because of all your decades of financial corruption in the state of New York, and creating the symbiotic relationship. It is horrible to see. And whatever people may say, oh, wealthy businessmen and women have always been like that in America. No, they haven't. They've never been so indebted and complicit in the individual corruption of one man. And that's what we're seeing right now.
Yep. And I agree with you. They're no different from oligarchs. I'm reminded of the San Francisco real estate billionaire who paid a ton of money through maybe Roger Stone to get a pardon from Trump when he left office. And all of the people that Trump pardons are either people with a bunch of money, like these oligarchs that, you know, are future oligarchs in a second Trump term, or people who have committed similar crimes, fraud, for example, money laundering, for example. Oh, and speaking of money laundering, and maybe we'll talk about this on the bonus episode, but the Department of Justice is going to seize a Trump Tower apartment of a former president of the Congo, who is a money launderer, hundreds of millions of dollars that he stole from the Congo using a Portuguese shell company. So I don't know how much of Trump is involved in that, but this, it's an asset forfeiture. One of the Trump Tower apartments for this guy who's a known money launderer. So that's interesting. But stuff like that, what, I mean, $84 million worth of, or 84%, I can't remember. It was either 84% or $84 million worth of Florida real estate owned by Donald Trump is, or sold by Donald Trump is owned by Russians. Like, it's just, it's a whole, it's a money laundering store.
Yes, it is. And either Eric, I think Eric, not Don Jr.'s statement, a disproportionate amount of our holdings are held by Russian interests. That's yes, mm-hmm. indeed. Don't even hide it. Don't even hide it.
This guy's from Congo. This guy's Congolese and apparently stole much of that. It makes me think of Jolo and Elliot Broidy. And stole all the money from Malaysia.
Hey, look.
And tried to get Bill Barr to not prosecute.
Maybe he can go hire Paul Manafort to do a little reputational rehabilitation. I'll hire him to lobby for.
Might as well.
Keep it all in the family.
Keep it all in the oligarch family. The new American oligarchs, who I hope will be defeated by democracy. All right, everybody, that is our show. If you're a patron, we'll see you later this week for the bonus episode. That's all. You $2 level patrons, you get twice as many episodes. And Pete gets sweary, and so do I. But I don't get as sweary as Pete. That's what's fun. I thought I had a potty mouth, but Pete puts me to shame. So we appreciate you supporting us, and everybody else listening. We just listening to this show supports us. So thank you. Thank you so much. And we'll see everybody. Go to allisonguild.com to get links to those pre-sale and VIP meet and greet tickets. And if you weren't able to make it to the April 20th DC meet and greet dinner. These VIP meet and greet events before the shows are actually smaller, and we're there hanging out. So it's, you know, we get to mingle, and that DC show is going to be me, Pete, Andy, Glenn Kirshner. It's going to be great. So I appreciate everybody and for supporting us, because it's patrons who help pay for these events. So thank you very much. I don't have anything else. Do you have anything else? Anything else, Pete?
Nope. Looking forward to this get together and, you know, plenty to talk about. And by the time that happens, you know, we're going to have trial up in New York, barring any sort of unforeseen event. But lots to talk about.
Yeah. And this show is going to be focused a lot on that trial. And we're going to be relying on the amazing reporting of folks like Adam Klasfeld and Katie Fang and Lisa Rubin and Anna Bauer. And I know she's Atlanta, but I know she's going to be working on this, too. So I know that a lot of these really amazing journalists, I'm going to be there for a week in May around a time I have to appear, not have to, I get to appear at the GMU at the Schar School Hayden Amphitheater with Andy for a show. And I'm going to try to go to the trial when I'm there. But, you know, this jury selection, because of what we learned today and how they, you know, you might not get the names of the jurors. This could take quite a while. So I don't know where we'll be in that trial, where along the schedule will be, but I will be there. I will see. And we're going to go over a lot of it on this show. It's going to take up probably two segments per show while we try to update everybody on everything else that's happening. So thank you so much, everybody. We'll see you next time. I've been Allison Gill.
And I'm Pete Strzok.
Clean Up on Aisle 45 is written, researched, and produced by Allison Gill, with editing by Molly Hockey. Our art and logo designer by Joelle Reeder and Moxie Design Studios, and our music is composed and performed by Adam Orr. Clean Up on Aisle 45 is a proud member of the MSW Media Network, a collection of creator-owned podcasts dedicated to news, politics, and justice. For more information, visit mswmedia.com. MSW Media.
Hi, this is John Cryer, and I am hosting a new 7-part true crime podcast called Lawyers, Guns, and Money that'll challenge everything you think you know about U.S. covert operations and presidential misconduct. From Jack Bryan, the director of American PSYOP, comes the incredible true story of John Mattis, a newly sworn-in Miami public defender in the 1980s who has found himself completely in over his head.
I step off the plane, and there is a van with a couple guys with Uzis. And one of them in broken English said, "Welcome to Bogota, John."
Mattis's first felony defendant has been arrested for having a machine gun and tells Mattis a dangerous secret.
He was shipping arms into Central America on behalf of the CIA. As a first-time lawyer, I want to act like I know what I'm doing.
But with the help of a Colombian drug smuggler...
How much money the CIA raised by hitting up drug dealers?
A lot of money, millions of dollars.
An Alabama mercenary...
They were prepared to die to the last man. I saw this in them. I saw the fire in their eyes. And they made me their war chief.
And a newly elected senator, John Kerry.
We are looking at allegations of drug running, gun smuggling, conspiracy to commit murder and murder itself.
He'll fight to free his client.
The judge said, "Show me in a courtroom how we were at war."
Expose an illegal war being run by the White House.
I mean, I wanted him involved, but I didn't want to be on record as doing it.
And somehow stay alive in the process.
I just escaped a kidnapping by the CIA in Costa Rica.
This is Lawyers, Guns, and Money.
So you have a man in an Armani suit standing on the bow of a boat with a rocket launcher and says, "If I lose sight of you, I will launch. You will be vaporized."
Available everywhere starting October 29th, or get it ad-free and early starting October 22nd at lawyersgunsandmoney.supercast.com. There you'll find bonus episodes along with exclusive content. Subscribe now.